Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and we are here to discuss the most talked about pieces of non-corona European legislation so far, the Digital Services Act and the Digital Market Act, also known with their acronyms of DSA and DMA. We are pleased to have a dream team of Bruegel experts to help me dissect and understand the new regulations. Hello Maria De Mertzis, Scott Marcus, Yorgos Petropoulos and Mario Mariniello. How are you doing?
Hello.
Hey.
Hello. Hi, everyone.
Just great. Good to be here.
Great. So, in a nutshell, the Digital Service Act is intended to strengthen the EU single market and clarify digital services responsibilities and liabilities, and the Digital Market Act tackles specifically the role of the so-called gatekeepers. And we will see what exactly gatekeepers are, both according to the European Commission and the new regulation, and in general, what exactly do we mean by gatekeepers in the digital market. The DMA apparently includes both ex-ante obligations as well as a new competition tool dedicated to the digital market. But as I can easily get lost into the acronyms and the details involved in the conversation, and our listeners could be easily lost too, I would like to proceed in a very systematic way and dedicate the first part of the podcast to understanding the Digital Service Act, a second part understanding the Digital Market Act, and a final reflection on the overall connection between those two regulations and their possible implications. So let me start with the Digital Service Act. Scott, can you explain us what exactly the Commission is proposing?
Thank you very much, Giuseppe. Well, let me begin by noting for our non-European audience and maybe our non-specialist Europeans as well, the European Union is a grouping of 27 countries, 27 member states. So a lot of what's being done at European level is to try to coordinate policy or harmonize policy among those 27 countries. And there are different ways that that's done. The legislative process requires the European Commission, the executive body of the European Union, to propose legislation, but the other branches also play a role. There's a European Parliament, which is elected, and a European Council representing the member states. In this case, the Parliament has already issued two own initiative reports telling the Commission what they want that law to do. And in fact, the Commission has been listening. So what we see are some very interesting legislative proposals. As you just heard from Giuseppe, there are two separate measures here. The Digital Markets Act, which is not going to be my focus at the moment, deals with issues that are closely related to competition law and antitrust. Digital Services Act is pretty much everything else about digital platforms. Now, this has to be understood in a longer-term context. Digital policy on both sides of the Atlantic for the last 20 years has largely been driven by a U.S.-originated mantra of don't regulate the internet. And that was largely carried over into European legislation, the e-commerce directive. A lot of what we see here in the Digital Services Act is an attempt to modernize key parts of the e-commerce act. But interestingly, they didn't repeal or replace it. The e-commerce act remains in effect except for a few articles. And that e-commerce act has had important consequences in terms of allowing the digital culture in Europe to evolve. It enabled digital firms in one of the European countries to do business in another without restriction. And it also said that when they do so, it's the country of origin rules that apply for most purposes. That hasn't changed. That remains in effect. And that's actually a very important provision. But there are several other areas where there are minor clarifications to a limitation of liability. Think of it this way. If you send a letter through the mail, the post office is responsible for delivering your letter. It's not responsible for the content. It's not responsible for what you wrote. In similar way, in the e-commerce directive and also in this Digital Services Act, basically, firms that provide only transmission of information, only caching, only hosting, but without looking at what's being hosted, those companies are also exempted from liability. And again, this has been hugely important in enabling the modern internet, the modern set of digital services to grow and evolve. So the legislative measures were pretty careful not to step on these valuable properties, but instead to preserve them and carry them forward. What we see, however, is a set of new obligations imposed on firms of different sizes. One of the more interesting bits about the Digital Services Act, and here we see some parallels to the Digital Markets Act, is that different obligations are imposed on firms of different sizes. Firms that are below the threshold of being micro-enterprise or small enterprise are exempted from large parts of the new obligations. Firms that they call very large platforms, and they define that as being firms that have an average monthly number of recipients, users, more than 10% of the European population, they have a bunch of new obligations imposed. And that threshold also appears in the Digital Markets Act, but together with quantitative thresholds on turnover, on volume of business as well. So again, the idea of different levels for different firms is important. Also important to note in these new measures, and actually in the package as a whole, is that it applies to all firms that provide services to European businesses or consumers, whether they're based in Europe or not. In other words, it's applied on an extraterritorial basis, as is the case with the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, and as is also the case with the Digital Markets Act. So those are some of the key underlying bits. Now, there are a number of things, a number of specific obligations. One is that these companies that do content moderation, that look at the data being sent and do things with it, those firms are required to do annual reports on how they've done content moderation. There are many new provisions about takedown of illegal content, and also on reporting on what they've done. There are new rights for consumers where if content is taken down, you have to be told why it was taken down or why it wasn't taken down, even though someone requested it. And there are rights of appeal that now become very explicit. So there are actually a number of important new protections for consumers and businesses that have been less clear in the previous law. For advertisements, there are new obligations where intermediaries have to ensure that the people who receive them are informed, first off, that the information is an advertisement. Often if you're on a search engine, it's not so clear when you look at, let's say, something on Google, is the search result actually a neutral result based on what you requested, or is it an advertisement popped up in response that was bumped to the top of the list because someone paid for it? Now you have to know that. You have to know why you were given an advertisement, and also you have to know on whose behalf the advertisement was posted. So there's really a lot more transparency than had previously been the case. One of the key parts of the new law is, and by the way, it's not yet law. I'll come back to this in a second. But one of the key parts for platforms that are very large, these platforms that serve in an average month more than 10% of the European population, they're now required to identify risks and define ways in which they plan to mitigate them and report annually or semi-annually on how well that's worked and what they've done. So what do we mean by risks here? This is probably going to be one of the most contentious bits of the new proposed legislation. The first part is uncontentious. You're supposed to report on anything that raises a risk of dissemination of illegal content through the service. I think that makes sense. Nobody's going to argue that. The third bit is any intentional manipulation of the service, misuse. So again, this is not terribly contentious. The second part, I think, is going to generate a lot of debate, and that is what's the risk of, and here I quote, any negative effects for the exercise of fundamental rights to respect for private and family life, freedom of expression, information, prohibition of discrimination, and rights of the child. So you know, on a positive note, clearly the intent here is to expand freedom of expression, to protect many of the rights that are visible in the European Charter. All good stuff. But what that's going to mean in practice, I think, is going to be hugely debated. And what it implies for the firms in practice is also likely to be hugely debated. To me, the interesting bit here is that these obligations to provide a risk assessment in advance, to create a mitigation plan, and to report back on how well that's worked, this puts the obligation on the companies to figure out how to solve risks specific to the particular business that they're in. This is a much better approach than what I had feared the Commission might try to do, which would be to create rigid individual rules, trying to shoehorn different firms with very different businesses into a common structure. Instead, it gives the companies the opportunity to say, based on what we actually do, this is how we think we can mitigate the risks that people are worried about. And I think it's quite clear on both sides of the Atlantic that people are worried about what's coming from these large digital platforms. So the concern is a valid one, but I think the risk here that this turns out to be too onerous a structure is there. The risk that the terms are either written too broadly or too imprecisely is there. I believe that the Parliament, Council, and surely the industry and their representatives and consumer representatives are all going to have, I expect, a very heated debate over how this works. But again, I think the structure that was taken here is a thoughtful one that makes sense. The mechanisms are logical. They leave some freedom to the companies. How well it will work in practice and what we actually get out of the process remains to be seen. Now, recall what we have is not law. It's a legislative proposal from the Commission. It's highly probable that a law will emerge. Again, we've seen already considerable agitation from the public. The public greatly appreciates all of these digital services. I greatly appreciate these services. You probably greatly appreciate these services. But we all see that there are risks associated with them. You know, fake news, illegal content, you name it. And so there's public agitation. The Parliament, which is an elected body and which is generally pretty pro-consumer, Parliament has, as I said, issued two reports. They want something. Council wants something. Some action is almost sure to happen, but it will probably take a year or two to rattle through a process that almost certainly will be one of the most heavily lobbied processes that we've seen in Brussels in recent years. And with that, I think maybe it's a good time to switch to where do we think the policy is going to go?
Yes, indeed, Scott. Thank you so much for the clarity, because as I said at the beginning, that's quite a complicated piece of regulation. And indeed, very good that you made the distinction between regulation and a directive and all the process, which is still ahead in time, in the sense that this is not the end of that process. It's rather a very important step, which will eventually get into a legislation. And I would like to turn to Mario to comment and zoom in on some of the issues that you pointed out, which are particularly worrying for the citizens, because you mentioned fake news, you mentioned the protection that the consumers would have or should have out of this piece of legislation when it comes to the liability of large platforms who are handling this this content. Mario, what is your first analysis and reflection on that aspect?
Well, thank you very much, Giuseppe. Thank you, Scott. I mean, it wasn't easy. I had to go through all this, you know, 80 pages and being able to make it so accessible. I think it's a good step that we are making. Of course, there are nuances. I will tell you in a second what I think are the things that I like the most, that I think they are going to be more effective, and those that I believe are more of a source of potential concern that we might adjust during the legislative process, as Scott has explained. But first of all, I think it's very important to make a clarification. This is a This piece of legislation proposal is not dealing with, let's say, fake news It's actually focusing on illegal content and not harmful content. That's a very important distinction that we have to make. So basically, platforms are prompted, let's say, to take down content which is deemed illegal. And then we will get to how illegal is defined, how a platform can detect, let's say, the presence of illegal content. But harmful content is a potentially larger category of content that you find online. So to make an example, if you have some content which is infringing copyright and is on a platform, that is, that potentially is an illegal content that has to be taken down. But if you have somebody who is saying that you can cure COVID-19 by drinking a lot of hot water, or somebody who's saying that vaccines are causing autism, well, that's harmful content, but it's not necessarily legal. And therefore, it's not basically of a concern for this specific piece of legislation. Is, of course, it's a difficult balance that the Commission has to take. Harmful content is a much more nuanced category and of content, and therefore it's difficult to deal with it. Illegal content is more precise. So,
Mario, if I may interrupt you. So, what you are saying is basically the legislation is proposed deals with a very limited aspect of the broader issue that it wants to tackle.
Exactly like that. Indeed, we are concerned about many things with platforms. This legislation will deal with some of it, but not the. It cannot tackle the whole picture. So what I think I like very much of this proposal is the attempt to give more transparency to this setting, and this is actually very 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 necessary. It's important. For example, the article that I like the most is Article 31, which gives the power to enforcers to actually look into what platforms are doing. It's gatekeepers, platforms that are particularly big. But it's very important that actually the outside world knows how platforms are dealing with these issues, that the more access, more transparency is granted, and that's I think that comes quite naturally, because if you have followed a bit the discussion that we had until now with platforms, the line that platforms have always taken is, well, we don't want to be the arbiter of what is legal and what is not. You should tell us. We don't want to take this decision. We don't want to censor anybody. Freedom of expression is, for us, is very important. So you should tell us. But at the same time, platforms have been quite secretive about what they are doing. So you see, the two things don't go well together, because if public authorities, forces, or whoever, he is in charge of checking the content online, is supposed to give platforms an indication on what it should be taken down, they should also be able to look into what platforms are doing. So an effort to make the activity of platforms more transparent, it's very, very welcome, in my view. There are many other things that are very important. I think certainly, as Scott has said, it's very important that the cornerstone, the safe harbor from general liability that was indeed enshrined in the EU legislation by the e-commerce directive of 2000 is kept, because that's really the basis of the internet, in Europe, but in general also the US have a very similar provision. I think it's very important. We can talk more about that if you want, but that was kept. But at the same time, there was a need to harmonize the approach throughout the whole digital single market, in Europe. There was this need, because this is a pressing problem. How do we deal with illegal content by online platforms? All member states started to take their own initiatives to tackle it. And that's actually not good. It's not good also for business, for online platforms themselves, because I mean they are, you know, they are coming to Europe and they have to deal with a very stringent law in Germany, then another very very stringent law potentially in France, and you know in all other member states. Instead, it's better to have like one single body of law, which I mean basically tackle the issue and is uniform across the single market. So that these are very, very important aspects. On the negative side, I don't know. I mean, like, you tell me if...
I would like to broaden up the discussion later on because I would like to give our listeners first the overview about the two pieces of legislations, and then we can have a little discussion about how we zoom out from the legislation to the consequences on the market and the wider society and other topics that are related. So I would actually like to ask you, Mario, if you could summarizes the DMA, the Digital Market Act, which is the other piece of legislation which went out on the 15th of December.
With pleasure. We try to be as eloquent as Scott was, though it's you know it's quite a bit of complexity here to deal with. Anyway, so I think perhaps the best way to explain this is that while the Digital Service Act is targeting all online platforms. There are some provision for bigger platforms, but you know the bulk of it is directed to all platforms. The Digital Market Act is instead specifically targeting a subset of online platforms, which are you know what the Commission call the digital gatekeepers. So the idea is really to have a list of practices that these large online platforms should refrain from implementing, and we could call this like a blacklist don't do it. And at the same time, a list of practices that these large platforms should actually actively promote. And this, we could call it the white list in order to be more clear. So the first important point of the regulation is really who is actually included in the gatekeeper category. And I know that, you know, later we will discuss with Gorgos a bit more the economics of it. But to explain the text of the proposal, the Commission actually indicates three criteria for defining a gatekeeper. First of all, the gatekeeper must have a significant impact on the internal market. Second, it must operate a core platform service, which serves as an important gateway for business users to reach end users. And the third condition is that it must enjoy an entrenched and durable position in its operations, or it may do so in the future. Okay, so these are three very general conditions. And I think they may sound quite vague, but this is actually made on purpose, and in fact because you know the category is going to it's a kind of a living entity if you want. It's something that is gonna change in the future, and I think this is a good aspect of the piece in the sense that the Commission recognized that we are dealing with a very dynamic sector that needs some adjustment. I mean, like it cannot. One of the biggest risks of this type of regulation is like to, you know, to be too much stiff in a very, very dynamic environment. So not to be able to adapt to the changing environment that comes. Anyway, at the same time, the Commission also suggests some quantitative thresholds. And so if these thresholds are met, then you would presume that the platform is indeed a gatekeeper. So the thresholds are that a platform has an average turnover in the last 3 years above 6.5 billion of euros in Europe, or an average market capitalization to at least 65 billion of euros. It must have been present in at least three member states. And in terms of users, it must have like approximately 10% of the EU population, so more than 45 million monthly active users, which are established or located in the EU, or more than 10,000 yearly active business users. Okay, so this is basically the quantitative thresholds that the Commission says, okay, if you are meeting these thresholds, then we presume that you have a very huge impact, that you are a gatekeeper in the according to the meaning of this regulation.
And Mario, just to move a little bit more fast on this, beside the definition of gatekeepers, which in a second I would like to go back because there are also some theoretical discussions around that that I would like to go more deep into, what exactly the DMA is finally proposing with the ex ante mechanism and the famous ex.
So just wanted to say, I mean, I think it's quite important. The regulation doesn't mention any company. Eh? We know who are probably the companies that very likely will fall into it. But I mean, the Commission doesn't mention it, and it will define this list in the future. Now, so that was the first point. Second point is about the obligation. So let me give you a couple of examples of the blacklist. So things that gatekeepers, those who enter this category, cannot do. They cannot use data that they have collected from business that they use their platform in order to compete with that business. Okay, that's one example. Another example is that under certain conditions, those gatekeepers cannot self-promote their own services, what is called, you know, self-preferencing. So basically, in other words, they cannot leverage their strong market position to gain an advantage over their competitors. This is, of course, as Scott pointed out, I mean, this is really at the intersection with antitrust issues. I mean, it's basically antitrust cases translated in what is called ex ante regulation, so it happens before a case can even potentially materialize. In fact, there are some ongoing cases and cases that the Commission has been dealing with in the past that actually resemble very much these obligations. If you take, for example, Amazon, the case against Amazon is exactly about the first example that I gave you. Basically, Amazon has been accused to use the data from the sellers that are using its marketplace in order to be able to better compete with those sellers in the marketplace that it owns. And this is considered unfair by the European Commission. Another, you know, classic example is Google Shopping, a case that was sorted out some time ago by the Commission, in which basically Google was accused to give prominence to its own results in the search results of Google. So it was like, you know, self-promoting Google services. And this, again, was in breach of antitrust. Maybe like one small point here, the reason why the Commission has basically opted to go from ex post enforcement. So, you know, somebody is doing something wrong, like in this case, Google with the Google Shopping, then we pursue it. So the Commission has moved from that ex post after the thing has happened enforcement to ex ante regulation, because they realize that ex post enforcement takes a lot of time. And this is actually very problematic in an environment like digital, which is, Google, I think it took like something like 9 years to get to the final decision. That is a bit of exception. But I mean, in general, they take quite a bit of time, because the conditions that you have to meet for antitrust to be able to show wrongdoing, they are very, very hard. Now, you can imagine, like, in 9 years, what can happen in the digital environment. Companies can come up, go bust. I mean, everything can change, right? So that's why the Commission wants to move to ex ante. In this way, it's taking some risk, though, because, of course, as I said, I mean, ex ante, it comes before, and it gives like some very strict rules that can be a little bit stiff. So that's why you need also to have somehow a way to adjust those rules in the future. But before going to Gorgos, because I'm afraid I'm taking too much time, I wanted to give you like a couple of examples of the whitelist. Because I mean, like, you know, you have the things that the companies should not do, but also things that companies should actually, gatekeepers should actually do. So this, for example, is to allow some third parties to interoperate with the platform, or they need to allow their business users to export the data that they generate from that platform. So what is the meaning here? I mean, these are kind of, you know, it can be quite tricky, you know, to understand what that means. But I mean, the general intuition behind here is that what the commission wants, like, is to stimulate competition in an environment which actually doesn't see naturally much competition, because these are services that work very well when everybody's using them. Okay, so I mean, that's what economists call network externalities. I use WhatsApp, but if I'm the only one who is using it, I mean, like, it's not useful, right? But if everybody else, all people in my circle, my friends, my family, everybody at the school of my daughter, basically using WhatsApp, then it becomes very useful. That's why competition is a bit tricky here. I mean, like, if you have a lot of people using different platforms, well, I mean, it's difficult. But the commission wants to sort that out with, you know, by basically granting more interoperability. So if you have platforms that are more interoperable, that means that they can coexist without losing the advantage of having a big network. So that's a little bit the intuition behind the blacklist, where you want to prevent antitrust infringements, let's say, to occur, coming before they happen, and with the whitelist, where you want to have, like, much more competition in an environment which naturally is not inclined to have it. And final point, if gatekeepers don't abide to these conditions that are defined by the regulation, then they can incur into sanctions which can be potentially very high. Actually, the upper ceiling of the fine is 10% of the global turnover of a gatekeeper. So potentially it's quite a bit of money. What is also very interesting is that the commission is saying that should the gatekeeper keep on, like, basically repeating the offense, and basically without, I mean, it gets fine, but I mean, like, it doesn't change its behavior, then the commission can also be empowered to impose behavioral remedies. So basically saying, okay, you now, gatekeeper, you have to do this, this, and this, and this, or even at the extreme, what they call the nuclear option, to unbundle the business. So even, like, impose some structural divestment. This is, of course, an option that, I mean, it's very unlikely to happen, but it's in the regulation, and potentially, I mean, the commission is saying that it could get that far.
Thank you, Mario. This was very comprehensive and clear. But I would like to turn to Yorgos, because you mentioned a couple of concept gatekeepers, interoperability, and Yorgos is working on those concepts. And I would like to, first of all, hear his take on all is going on in the DMA, but also let us explain a bit more what there is behind those kind of concepts.
Yeah, thanks, Giuseppe. I think Scott and Mario covered very well the two acts. I mean, the first broad comment is that with these acts, the Commission signals that with great power, should come together with great responsibility, great obligations that we need to have in digital markets. And I think the contribution of the proposals is that they provide a clear understanding, a clear path to understand what are these obligations. So the first big win with this proposal is that we have more transparency over the issues that we need to deal with and how we should deal with them. The second general point is that breaking up digital platforms should not be the solution. We are talking about specific obligations that go beyond such extreme structural measures. And I think that has a particular value, especially since breaking up platforms has been intensively discussed in the debates. Moving forward, we should pay particularly attention to the so-called gatekeepers. And in simple words, how can we define a gatekeeper? It's a platform that facilitates many interactions among business users, end users, consumers, developers, external producers. And therefore, when this platform becomes the only path to facilitate this interaction, is basically a necessary gate for the different users that they need to go through in order to participate in the ecosystem. They are platforms that exert a great control over the other users of the ecosystem. And as Mario mentioned, there are specific criteria in the proposal in order to define these gatekeepers. The two comments I want to make here is, first of all, these criteria can be very easily measured. We don't have, for example, intensity of network effects that could be something subjective how to assess it. We have clear measures that can be assessed. We see that the number of users using these platforms become an important criterion. I mean, if I want to be a little bit critical, I would like also the definition to include the ability of users to interact with each other outside the platform, some measure related to the ability of users to multi-home for a given service of given quality. It may be the case that that has been proven to be so difficult to measure in practice, and for this reason, the Commission didn't include it. I don't know exactly. But in principle, that is also something that is very relevant to the gatekeeper status. And I think it will be interesting to see how this definition will come forward. We all have in our minds some platforms that they are the usual suspects. The question is whether we will have also some surprises in this list. The other dimension I would like to mention is that in addition to the obligations that I will come shortly and I will discuss of this very big platform, the gatekeepers, there is an additional obligation related to merger control. And in Article 12, the gatekeepers are obliged to report all the mergers and acquisitions they are involved. That basically goes beyond the notification thresholds that we have in Europe and apply to big firms. Those are thresholds related to turnover. However, for the gatekeepers, those thresholds are not relevant for the notification of the merger that they are involved. Now, going to this dimension, I think it's something really important because we have multiple mergers by big platforms in the digital sector. However, the vast majority of them, probably more than 97%, haven't been investigated. So notification empowers the authorities to investigate more measures. This zero threshold of notification makes possible for the authorities to investigate more measures. Of course, there are also resource constraints that should be taken into account. But by investigating more mergers, we can understand better the motives of these mergers and how or what is their impact to the ecosystem. So it is a positive step. Now, going to the list of obligations, Mario talked about the blacklist. I would disagree a little bit on the color. I will call it dark gray list. And the reason is that in Article 7 of the proposal, basically what the Commission says is, okay, we have defined these, obligations for platforms, but you know something, if the platform comes forward and provide objective justification why these obligations should not apply for that particular platform, then we'll take this into account. It does not mean that all these lists will apply to all the gatekeepers. And it will be interesting to see how this discussion will evolve, how platforms will react to this open window that the Commission gives, and correctly, to my view, it gives, because each business model is different from the other, and the obligations also should take into account the particularities of the business models. So it will be interesting to see what will be the final list of obligations and how they will be implemented for each of the gatekeepers. I can come back forward with some further comments on the obligations.
Thank you, Yorgos. Just one word before zooming out a little bit, because you already started to have a discussion that goes broader. When you say multi-homing for our listeners, what exactly do you mean?
In practice, a very big platform, facilitates a particular activity between the different users. Let's take, for example, online search. Online search allows user to reach to a content provider or the external producer based on his interest as the user expressed them with a keyword search. So the question is, to what extent the user can reach the other side, the business side, the content provider he wants to reach outside the platform? Are there alternative options that give him this opportunity? And the relevant question is, if I type the keyword in one search engine, I get immediately the result that I want. If I type the same keyword in another search engine, will I get immediately what I'm looking for? So do we have other options of services that provide the same quality that we could use? And I think that is an important dimension for defining the gatekeeper. Gatekeepers, in principle, facilitate many interactions. They have great market share, and this is because the users have the limited ability to use other channels for their online operations.
So basically, this would mean opening up the algorithm and making it clearly available for or not, because there is a whole discussion about opening the algorithms of search engines.
Well, I mean, we see that in the light gray list of the obligations, we have one obligation that it says that the gatekeeper should allow third-party providers to have access to click data, to ranking data, and so on. But this is access to the data, not the algorithm. Of course, in the enforcement side of the proposal, the commission also wants to have access to the algorithm, but I'm not sure if this will be helpful, because the algorithm is, in many cases, a black box. Even I have access to the code of the algorithm, it's difficult to understand what the algorithm does. What is much more important and helpful is to be able for the authority to test the algorithm with some data set that it is unbiased, and put this data set as an input in the algorithm and see what the output will give out. But on the degree of multi-homing, that goes beyond. I mean, this access is not necessary. It's what we need to monitor is whether users have used more than one platform, for example, for a specific given service, and whether they derive the same value. It is the same quality interaction.
Yeah, so in the end of the day, it comes back to consumers' rights and consumers' easiness and quality. And on this, if I may, because otherwise we could easily slip into a very technical discussion about algorithms and which I would be personally very interested in, but it will go a little bit off of the topic. I would like to turn to Maria and get back to the bigger picture about, I mean, we got a clear view about the two tools which have been released on the 15th of December by the European Commission. What are your first reflections when it comes to zooming out of the sector to the implication for economy and economic policy in general?
Yeah, thank you, Giuseppe, and thank you all. This has been really a very interesting and informative discussion in terms of what is going on in this respect. I wanted to sort of go back a little bit and understand what is the motivation behind all of this. And I think one thing that became actually very obvious from the comments that you made is that when the Commission proposes a legislation that it calls the Digital Services Act, it really has the citizen in mind. But when it proposes the Digital Market product, then it has the consumer in mind, right? So the first one is about, you know, how do I deal with this thing called digital? And actually, I have something to do to protect the citizens' rights. And so not the economics of it, but the citizen. But when it comes to the Digital Markets Act, it's much more about really the economic models. How do we structure the economy? How do we stay, you know, faithful to the principle of economics that we have here in the European in the European economic markets? Now, one thing that is also very clear about all of this is that size matters. Right. And, you know, in both proposals, you will see that there is a need to differentiate between the big guys and the small guys, both on the citizen side and also on the consumer side. There are different responsibilities that come with that. And I think that's an important thing to understand. But, you know, what I think is also interesting to talk a little bit about here is that why is that size is important on the digital arena and it might not be important elsewhere? Or is it important elsewhere, let's say, in the car manufacturing or in pharmaceuticals? Or in aviation, all these firms have also got an issue of size. And you know what is so specific on the digital? And I like to always quote Scott when I talk about the digital, who always tells us, "Well, you know, everything is digital nowadays." So there is something specific about the digital that is different from others that is conducive to scale, because all the services, all the products will have a digital component, and therefore they will have a need for something that is slightly different. And in fact, if you look back at the development of the digital economy, I mean, what is different about the digital economy in this respect? I personally think there are two things that are different, and therefore they require a very specific approach to them. And that is that there is a very clear first mover advantage. Those who come in first, they lock themselves in and become big. And why do they become big? They become big because they can do it without very little capital, right? I mean, the ability of the digital economy to grow and capture shares of the market or be relevant to the society can happen with actually very little capital in ways that other industries cannot do. If you want to build another car site, you need more capital to build that capital site. If you are Facebook, you can expand your market in different countries with just basically buying more cloud space. And that the differences in investments that are required are very different, you see. So this effectively gives the digital economy a very rapid ability to grow very fast and possibly capture things that are of interest to society that other firms cannot do it. And this is why I think the digital economy is an economy that requires multiple regulations that may perhaps differentiate from other companies. And they also, they transcend sectors. It's not just about one sector. It applies to things that has to do, as we heard, on safety around security, to harmful issues that are not illegal, but may be harmful, but all the way to economic business models. And there, I think, what the Commission is now trying to do is, okay, let's understand how these new digital firms, the big firms, the gatekeepers, how do they alter fundamental things to our society? So, you know, the regulation of content or the data, but how do they also exploit market power that is going to affect the functioning of our economy? And I think this is where the rationale behind here is. Now, I also like to point out that the digital economy is not very much a European economy. What I mean by that is the big market leaders here are not European firms. They are primarily American firms, but we also see now with the emergence of China, there is big firms that are coming there. So, you know, what is here the edge in Europe? Well, I mean, the edge in Europe is the regulation of these companies. There is a very good interest to understand how we need to regulate to protect some of the function of the economy. So this is what I think is the rationale behind these two acts. I don't believe that we understand the limits of the digital economy. I mean, you know, we are learning. It's a very much, this regulation is very much a reactive regulation. I would argue that probably most regulation is reactive regulation, but in the case of the digital economy, there is so much in the complexity of the business that we don't know that, you know, small steps will always tackle small problems. But I mean, the potential for different problems is just enormous.
Yes, indeed. I wanted to open up a round of comments on this. And Maria, thanks, because this really enlarges the conversation to the wider aspects and implications that those two regulations have. Mario.
Thank you, Maria. Thank you, Giuseppe. Of course, there are a lot of things we could discuss. And thank you for pointing many of those out. I'll start with the first thing that you pointed out, which is, you know, the DSA is about citizens and the DMA is about consumers. But I would say that, maybe a little bit you have that flavor. But if you think about that carefully, the digital economy, the distinction between citizens and consumers is very, very blurred somehow. And I think a good way to see it is really if you consider the harmful content, the concept of harmful content. Why, even if, as I said, I mean, this is not the Digital Service Act is not specifically targeting the harmful content, but not specifically, just you know, of course, you have the risk assessment of the big platforms. But I mean, for the core is not addressing harmful content. But what I would like to say is that. When the quality of the service of a platform is somehow going down, when you have big scandals, because maybe a platform is riddled with illegal content or harmful content, what can consumers and citizens that are using those services do? Well, not much, because there is no competition. I mean, so platforms, big platforms do not pay for the loss in their reputation that much, because you don't have alternatives. Okay, so in that sense, like if you take the DMA, which has the purpose of stimulating competition, of allowing a market to become even more dynamic, to have potential business models that, you know, are not there yet, that are less reliant on, for example, on the virality of certain content to emerge. In that sense, they are also helping, you know, to improve the quality of platforms, the quality of the information that you find. So I think it's very difficult to, you know, to distinguish the two things. They come together to address an issue which is relevant for us by different dimensions, you know, certainly as consumers, but also as citizens. On the first mover advantage, it's clear. I agree with everything that you said. Maybe perhaps a comment about, you know, you said that this is a global issue. Clearly, I think it's a very, very important point indeed, and I also think that it is a bit of a tricky moment for Europe to deal with this stuff. First of all, because, you know, you have a lot on the plate. You have taxation, you have artificial intelligence, you have data transfer, you have trade issues in the digital domain, et cetera, et cetera. They're all domains that have clearly a global implications. And also there will be a new administration in the US soon, and there will be the opportunity to rebuild some bridges. Yeah? So, I mean, this initiative has to be put also in that context. How this is going to be perceived by the US, and whether this is going to be like entering the same package with all these other issues that are contentious or not. Now, in my view, there is a momentum in the US as well to tackle these issues, because it's clear that there are issues in the digital domain that have to be addressed, and it's time to do it. The Commission has tried in the past in many ways, also with self-regulatory, like softer, let's say, interventions, and it didn't work. We need to do something about it. In the US, they are doing exactly the same. The investigation to unbundle Facebook, I think it's telling. I mean, there is a common concern that there is something to do about it. So I personally think that the Commission should try to take this opportunity to not to present this as an unilateral initiative, but something more like that we can do together, we can coordinate together to tackle issues that basically affect the world economy. I think there is scope for being able to tackle issues that concern the world population of the world.
Scott, what do you think?
Thanks. Well, I agree with pretty much everything that's been said, but I've got a little different spin or a little different angle on a few of the points that I'd like to bring out. First, as far as whether DMA is more about consumers, a lot of it is about consumer welfare implicitly, but all competition policy is about consumer welfare. It seems to me that, first off, what DMA is really focused on is business-to-consumer platforms, not necessarily all platforms. That's really explicit in the writing. And in this case, a lot of what they're seeking to do is to facilitate competitive entry of businesses. And the concern is that these very broad economies of scope potentially get in the way. So it's trying to open things up. Now, I think this needs to be seen in the context of digital platforms now being a mature industry, where our regulatory frameworks on both sides of the Atlantic have tended instead to keep out of the way, thinking, well, it's still emerging, we don't know what to do. At this point, we see what the harms are and we need to react. In most network industries, there's a mix of techniques used to regulate. We've got competition law coming in only after the fact and only after something bad has been done. But what we know from network industries is if you leave it to that, you never get competitive entry. In telecommunications, but also in areas like post and electricity and rail transport, if there weren't in advance regulation, this ex ante that Mario was talking about, you wouldn't get competitive entry. There actually was a natural experiment. New Zealand tried to operate just with competition law. It was awful. They gave it up after a few years because they couldn't get any competitive entry. So so you need something. And that's why I think the DMA is in the right direction. Now, with that said, I think the debate we're about to have, really on both pieces of legislation, but especially on the DMA, I think we're going to hear an awful lot about geese and about eggs, specifically golden eggs. The question will be whether the price that we pay for getting that competitive entry is really worth it. The very economies of scale and scope that generate consumer benefits are also the things that make it hard for a new small competitor to get up to scale. So so I think the question of whether the game is worth the candle, again, the question of these geese and eggs, is, I believe, going to be very much a debate, including an economic debate, and probably an economic debate that we at Bruegel as economists should be keeping in mind. I'd like to touch a third issue that hasn't been mentioned in any of the previous comments, or barely anyway, and that's single market aspects. One of the great strengths of the European Union is that we take these 27 countries plus a few hangers-on, and we try to create a somewhat integrated market out of them. What both of these measures try to do is to create a so-called regulation that has direct effect in the 27 countries without requiring national legislation to implement them. So it's trying to create more commonality than historically exists. But it did more. In the DSA, they also produce digital service coordinators that are supposed to oversee this. They're effectively national regulatory authorities, similar to what we have in telecoms, also in electricity, also in post, that would take a national role. And there would be a European level board, which the Commission wants to chair, to try to coordinate policy among the different national authorities. So again, trying to put things on a common line where, as Mario earlier noted, we've had some proliferation of national legislation that could have easily produced fragmentation across the 27 countries. Trying to create more of a common line is a key theme, really in both pieces of legislation, especially though in the DSA. This is an area that in Europe is always delicate. The European institutions typically want more of a hold on things. The member state governments want to retain their autonomy. Both are understandable. Neither is wrong. But striking the right balance will be important. And I think that this is going to be one of the more hotly debated points. I would agree with Mario that the measure as written could have been very protectionist. They took considerable pains not to do that. We all know that the platforms that they're talking about, mostly are not based in Europe. They're mostly based in the United States. Increasingly, we may be seeing entry from China. The measure tried to create quantitative objective thresholds that were independent of where the companies were based and tried not to inappropriately target specific U.S. companies. So that, I think, was important and correct. The last point I'd like to come back to is this question of harmful versus illegal content. I think Mario and I are largely in line on this. The DSA took pains to make the explicit measures about takedown and redress and so on. That's specifically about illegal content, not about harmful. But I think a close reading of these co-regulatory provisions, the risk assessment, the very first thing that they ask the companies to report on is their content moderation practices. And there's also a requirement for them to do an annual report independent of the large platforms on what they've done about content moderation. I think the risk that they're concerned about when they talk about risk to family, risk to freedom of expression, fake news and harmful news, news that's not necessarily illegal, you know, not illegal, but still harmful by some definition, I think actually is an important thrust, but it's treated as a self-regulatory theme. We have at the moment some voluntary schemes that are already involved in content moderation of the large platforms. There's been large dissatisfaction with how they've worked, even though, I mean, the companies have done things. You know, there has been measures taken, but one can argue how effective they've been. The commission seems to be less than 100% thrilled with them. I think the parliament as well. So I think this is going to be one of the key delicate issues. And to me, one of the key shifts with the DSA was to make it possible to mandate things in this space that up to now have been purely voluntary. But again, the approach taken here is co-regulatory. In other words, the impetus comes from the firms, but the European institutions, especially the Commission, effectively can make obligations mandatory and can enforce and can, if need be, impose penalties. So this kind of co-regulatory scheme, I think, is greatly better than a hard scheme, but there's considerable question, I think, still, how well will it work in practice, and making it work is going to be important. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. And Yorgos, we are basically going through some final round of comments because we need to wrap up.
Yes. So, I mean, we should not forget that digital platforms are multi-sided markets. So focusing on consumers means also that we need to focus on business users. And I think that the DMA does it that to a great extent. So we see that the obligations target to allow business users to use alternative platform providers at minimum switching cost to create a fair competition between platform-owned services and business users who compete for the eyes of consumers, and to create a better information sharing so that we have will not have the big platforms that have the big information advantage. Of course, consumers also should not be locked to particular platform services, and there are some obligations that go to this direction. So we see that there is a sufficient effort through their obligations to make both consumers and business users to feel free to use alternative digital channels to interact with each other, to transact with each other. One of the key aspects I think that we should underline is the great information asymmetries that we have today in platform ecosystems, the big platform ecosystems, the ones that which can be classified as gatekeepers. And this is because the platform uses its information advantage to give an extra value to the intermediation service it provides. So I think a key element, a key objective for the future is to try to reduce this information asymmetries and make this information flow both to consumers and the other business users, the third parties, from the gatekeeper. And if this is an objective, we need something more than the current regulation. We need some minimum interoperability and compatibility standards. We need some guidance how we will be build the infrastructure for this information sharing, how what are the particular rules. And this goes far beyond saying that we need to have data portability, we need to have interoperability. The rules should also go to the direction on how to achieve that, what are the technical standards that we need to impose to make this a reality. And with this respect, probably a six-month period for the implementation of such measure, it is a short one. And I will stop here.
Thank you. Thank you, Yorgos. Maria, maybe some final reflections to conclude this very rich episode of The Sound of Economics.
Yeah, just one comment picking from what Scott said on this issue of trying not to be protectionist, which I think it's the theme of the decade, I think. And, you know, with a new US administration, you know, hopefully we will be able to have more cooperative discussions. However, I will say this. You know, as I said, the digital companies, the ones that we're really trying to sort of regulate here, are non-European companies and primarily US companies. So whether we like it or not, I think, and despite our better efforts, the perception will be, I think, that, you know, the Europeans are directly trying to limit the flexibility that these companies have. I think it will not be difficult to see from the US side any attempts by the European Commission to regulate the digital economy as an attempt to also limit the influence that the American companies can have, or indeed Chinese when we come to that. So, you know, if you put next to that also this idea, this thing that the next issue that we're going to have to discuss is how are we going to tax these economies, then you can really see that there's building up the antagonism with the US. Now, I'm not saying that this is what it is, but there's certainly a perception that Europe will be regulating against the power coming from the West. Now, this will make for some very interesting discussions. But, you know, as we are now hoping to rekindle our love affair with the US, this is going to be something that will have to be discussed with the US in the context of what package of policies are going to bring greater multilateral and global cooperation.
Indeed, Maria, you put it exactly the way it should be. And I think that we will have many more discussions around all this, not only about the specifics of the digital economy, but also within the more geopolitical aspects. And basically, of course, the digital, as you mentioned before, it's basically pervasive of every single other aspects of the economy. So we will come back to this and to the consequences and the analysis of the new regulation that that the European Commission has been proposing. And as Scott has been reminding us, this is only a first step within the legislative process. It's not the final step. So we will for sure at Bruegel continue and keep to monitor the development of this process. We will keep analyzing the consequences, and you will see on our blog and our publication pages in the next months for sure more work coming from Mario, Scott, Yorgos, and more experts, and Maria, and so on, from that point of view, as well as probably more episodes of The Sound of Economics, which will come later on in 2021 on this topic. So this brings us to the end of this episode. I would like to thank Maria, Mario, Scott, and Yorgos. Thank you so much.
Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks a lot to all our listeners for joining The Sound of Economics. And I would like to remind you that all our analysis and publications and all episodes of the podcast are available on the Bruegel website on www.bruegel.org. Until next time, bye-bye.